Europe tells Apple to pay up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The EU orders Apple to pay Ireland more than $14 billion in back taxes. But both Apple and Ireland like things the way they are.
Both sides seem to want it to carry on, and both sides are accusing Brussels of, frankly, interfering in affairs which are none of their business.
Plus, black girls at a South African high school were recently told to straighten their hair and cut off their dreadlocks.
It's a school in Africa. Why are we not allowed to be black in Africa? Where can we be black if we can't be black in Africa?
And some see a new market for supersonic flight.
It's appealing to me to think that I could fly over to Europe, have a meeting, and fly back.
But the price might be too high. Those stories coming up today here on The World. Good to have you here. Personal note, I grew up in the South in the 60s and 70s and saw many examples of racism. Perhaps I equate the passage of time with a natural progress forward, and yet we know that isn't the case. Just ask Colin Kaepernick, quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, explaining his motivation for not standing when the national anthem is played.
I mean, ultimately, it's to bring awareness and make people, you know, realize what's really going on in this country. There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust. People aren't being held accountable for, and that's something that needs to change. That's something that, you know, this country stands for: freedom, liberty, justice for all. And it's not happening for all right now.
Kaepernick has his reasons for protesting the national anthem, but the song itself is worth looking at on this count, and later we'll dig into the backstory of one verse of the Star-Spangled Banner some historians consider racist. First up on The World today, though, fresh allegations of racism in South Africa. 12 years after the end of apartheid, black students at Pretoria High School for Girls are told to chemically straighten their hair. Tisetso Petla is an alumna of Pretoria High School for Girls. She's on the line with us from Pretoria. So take us to the beginning. When did the school start telling black girls to chemically straighten their hair and not wear afros?
It was way before me. When you apply to Pretoria High School for Girls, they ask you to give in an ID picture of yourself. At the time, I had an afro and I applied with an afro. I got accepted to the school thinking that it's okay to have one, because before you enter the school in grade 8, they give you a code of conduct to read and to sign off. There is nothing with regards to African hair or an afro in the code of conduct. So knowing that, I thought it was okay to come to school with my natural hair. When I got there, I was told that I looked very untidy and I looked as if I wasn't part of the school uniform.
So did they make you chemically straighten your hair?
They asked several times. They would remind me every day.
And did you?
No, I refused. Because if I do use chemicals on my hair, then my scalp gets extremely damaged.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, I mean, how does it actually work? Because I know in the old days, African Americans would straighten their hair with lye and it would burn.
It burns. It really burns.
So is this a written rule at Pretoria High School for Girls? I mean, have you seen this in some rule book there?
No, it's not written. That was our argument. The fact that you are asking us to do something that is not within the code of conduct. It's not a rule in the school. However, when you do walk around, they tell you verbally. I think if it was a rule, then it's something that you can take forth to court and it's something that you can debate for it to be removed. But the mere fact that it's not written on paper, they just say it to you verbally every single day and you get punished for it. And when they do write your punishment, they don't say that you are being punished for bearing your African hair. They just say for looking untidy in school uniform. They hide behind that rule.
So what has reaction been? It sounds like it's been pretty explosive.
During our years, we allowed the system and the school to silence us. We tried to bring it up and they would tell us that they would consider it. However, the matter never went any further than the principal. Now the girls, because I matriculated in 2014, the current grade 8 students said that this is not fair and everyone else should hear their cry and they should be supported.
What do you think's changed? Why is this happening? Why is this debate kind of erupting now?
Because they've seen that them trying to have us to straighten our hair, it's them devaluing the African woman. They're taking away our black heritage. The question is, if we cannot be black in school, where can we be black? It's a school in Africa. Why are we not allowed to be black in Africa? Where can we be black if we can't be black in Africa?
And it's especially poignant because this specific high school, Pretoria High School for Girls, I mean, this was previously an all-white school, right?
Yeah, it's a former Model C school.
Yeah, so how does that play into everything and the headiness of what's going on right now with this hair debate?
The problem is that in 1994, when South Africa was set free from apartheid, they didn't dismantle their old code of conduct. They just added a few rules to try and accommodate the black child. They didn't go back and dismantle everything and welcome the black child. The black child was never welcomed. They were just accepted for education purposes.
The administration at Pretoria High School for Girls, is it mixed? Is it white? Is it black? Who's running the school?
The top four are all white. The school has a very low ratio when it comes to black people because the school has about 1,500 students and there are only 5 members of staff of color. And I'm including a mixed race teacher in that 5.
So with this hair debate at Pretoria High School for Girls as kind of a snapshot of racial progress in South Africa, how has that triggered a new conversation?
It has shown how racism is still alive in South Africa. We are only free in terms of where we travel and how we travel. But in terms of us being black and being able to express ourselves, we still have a very long way to go.
Let me ask you this. If the administration of Pretoria High School is saying, well, you look untidy, do they ever urge anybody to just cut all their hair off? I mean, there are a lot of countries in Africa that demand that girls and boys are shorn when they come to school.
They tell us to straighten or braid. Any look that's close enough to the Western look is what they want. Mm. So if you come and you're bald, they'll make you sit in the office up until your hair is a certain length again. You won't be allowed into a classroom or attend an assembly or anything along those lines where the public can see you because they say you bring shame to the school.
In the same vein, Tisetso, I understand that some black students at the school have said on social media that the school didn't allow them to speak ethnic languages, local languages, aside from English.
Children that are Afrikaans and the Spanish kids and the German kids are allowed to speak their native tongues, but we South Africans are not allowed to speak our African native tongues. Your Sepedi, Zulu, Xhosa, the only languages that they didn't even debate with them when they spoke their own languages are the Afrikaners, the Germans, and the Spanish kids.
I mean, it really feels like there are a lot of issues from the apartheid era that are alive and are unsettled. Where do you think this is all headed? How do you think it's going to settle?
These new kids are revolutionaries. It's scary to think that they were born in 2002, but they're not having any of it. They are now compiling a new code of conduct that is for the black child. It accommodates the black child. It includes every single child that comes to Girls High. I mean, how does your hair affect your education? How does your hair affect the next person's education? It's about the look. These kids say that they do not want to look Western. They are not Western. They want to look African because they are Africans. This is South Africa. They refuse to conform to the Western ways that they're trying to impose on us, and which they were very successful in my generation on imposing.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, how does that make you feel, you know, as a graduate of Pretoria High School for Girls? Do you kind of wish that you had spoken up more or done something else?
I'll be honest, the majority of us, we actually embarrassed with ourselves because we failed to speak up. But another thing is, when you are inside the institution, they teach you that it's okay for them to indoctrinate you the way they indoctrinate you. They teach you that their ways are the correct ways. African ways are rather barbaric. Every connotation there is with the African culture, they take it back to it being in a barbaric sense.
Tisetso Petla graduated from Pretoria High School for Girls in 2014. Thank you very much for speaking with us, Tisetso.
It's a pleasure.
By the way, the local Ministry of Education is looking into the students' concerns, and Pretoria High School for Girls says it will work with the ministry to address the issues the girls raised. This next story has a moral to it. Take a bite of the apple, but watch out for the worm. Apple as in the tech giant. Here's the backstory. Apple had a sweet deal in Ireland for nearly 25 years from 91 just up to last year. The company, based as we all know in Cupertino, California, attributed sales to a head office in Ireland. That allowed Apple to pay a corporate tax of about 1%. This was supposedly all legal, and Apple in Ireland liked the deal. But a 3-year investigation by the European Commission concluded the arrangement is illegal. It says Apple owes Ireland $14.5 billion in back taxes. What's interesting about it is that both Apple and Ireland are going to appeal the decision. So what is up? My colleague at the BBC, Rory Kethlin-Jones, is here now to explain. First of all, does this ruling come as a surprise?
Well, it's not a complete surprise in that 2 years ago, the European Commission first wrote to the Irish government saying it believed that this was an offence against their rules. This amounted to state aid, which is illegal in the EU, and it was expressing its concern about it. What's come as a huge surprise is the sheer scale of the amount that they want Apple to pay back in terms of back taxes. There was a similar case involving Starbucks and the Netherlands government, where Starbucks was ordered to pay something like 30 million euros, about $30 million, in fact. And so the fact that we're talking billions here rather than millions, that comes as a huge surprise.
Yeah, and $14.5 billion in back taxes. Does that suggest how good a deal this all was for Apple?
Well, yeah, there's quite a lot of detail in the European Commission's finding on this. And effectively, they're saying vast amounts of revenue from all around the world were being funneled through Ireland, and they're paying very little tax. Ireland has a corporate tax rate of 12.5%. But the Commission says that at one stage, it was paying a rate of 0.005%.
Wow.
In other words, on $1 million, it was paying basically $50 in tax.
That's incredible. So how does Ireland feel about the ruling? Because they get billions back in back taxes at some point, but they also seem to like the arrangement with Apple.
Well, here's the interesting thing. The Irish government, and I think there's a bit of a row within Ireland about this, but the Irish government is appealing against it. Basically, it's being found guilty of breaking European law. It doesn't believe that's the case. Yes, there's this huge windfall, but Ireland's whole policy over the last 25, 30 years has been to try and attract the world's big technology names. And it's been pretty successful in that. Lots of other American technology firms there too. And its relationship with Apple goes back an enormously long way. It was in 1980 that Steve Jobs first traveled to Cork in Ireland and set up Apple's first European operation there. So it's a long relationship which has survived through thick and thin. And both sides seem to want it to carry on. And both sides are accusing the European Commission in Brussels of, frankly, interfering in affairs which are none of their business.
How is this decision going to affect the Irish themselves?
Well, the Irish citizens, we've had a few interviews with Irish citizens in Cork today. They seem to have mixed views. Some people are saying, wow, that did seem like we gave them a ridiculously generous deal. But others saying, hey, well, we like the jobs and we don't want the jobs to go. I mean, Apple is waving a sort of red flag and warning that this could affect investment across Europe. I think a lot of people are basically sitting in, who've watched these kind of investigations over the years, are preparing for the lawyers to fight long and tedious battles. And I think the betting is that huge sum probably never will be paid in the end.
You know, Rory, everybody thought the big Apple story right about now would be the release of the iPhone 7, which rumor has it is coming soon. What does this news mean for Apple? Does it sober them up? Will it impinge on their profits?
When you think of how much money, over $200 billion, is in Apple's cash pile, even $14 billion won't really make much of a difference. And as I said, they're very unlikely to be paying it in the short term. What it does mean is that Apple is entering an environment, as a lot of other multinational companies, which is more hostile to these kind of sweetheart deals. And we'll have to work out, you know, what that means for its relationships with countries around the world.
My BBC colleague, Rory Cathlin-Jones, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
You're with the world. In 2011, I traveled to northeast Japan to witness the devastation after the quake, tsunami, and meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear power plant. It left me numb because there is so much work to do to clean things up and deep fears about living with radiation into the future. Tohoku, as the northeast region is known, needed all hands on deck. Enter Tomohiro Narita, a biker covered with tattoos who runs a motorcycle shop in Niza City, Japan. He led an unlikely group of former convicts, tattoo artists, and other bikers into the disaster zone. Their nickname, Support the Underground. Our partners at the BBC program Outlook sent reporter Emily Webb to Niza City to meet Narita.
We're now coming into Narita's motorbike yard, and we're getting a full tour, seeing his incredible selection of bikes.
My bike. Narita is a recovering drug addict and always has a cigarette in his hand. He lights them throughout our interview. When I first meet him, I'm struck by his arms, which are covered in tattoos. This isn't a common sight in Japan, where tattoos are often associated with gangs. There are even shops that won't let you inside if they spot an inking.
When I first came to Tokyo about 30 years ago, young people could not legally get tattoos. There weren't many tattoo artists, but I found one and asked him to do it because it was a way of stopping myself from going down a conventional path in life, like working in an office, because that would have been very easy to do.
Instead, he joined the Bozozuku, a motorbike gang whose name translates to violent speeding tribe. They're known for driving around at speed, jumping lights, but Narita insists it was all innocent fun.
There are various kinds of Bozozuku. Some are bad, but we were purely bike lovers who just loved driving around. But at the time, we also caused trouble to other people. We'd drive around and do things like ignore the signal lights, which I'm sorry about now. At the time, we were just having fun.
Narita went on to build up his custom motorbike business and things were going pretty well. But on March the 11th, 2011, disaster struck.
For those of you who have just tuned in to NHK World, a major earthquake hit Japan Friday afternoon, about an hour ago, hour and 10 minutes ago.
Japan's meteorological... The area hit by the earthquake included the town where Narita grew up in the northeast.
...upwards to 8.4. The agency has issued a tsunami warning for Japan's Pacific coast. In northeastern Japan's Iwate Prefecture, tsunami waves of over 4 meters...
Narita's parents and many friends were still in the area, but totally cut off.
I couldn't get through to anyone at all, as all the lines were down. After 3 days, I eventually got through to my friend, who said, "You have to help us."
Narita got together a group of friends, some other bikers, tattoo artists, even some ex-convicts. They collected supplies, got hold of some vehicles, and made the journey up north.
When we eventually arrived, it was terrible. The place looked like a war zone. There were so many devastated people. It was really shocking. I'm not sure if I were in the situation again, I'd be able to do it. On that trip, I met a 6-year-old girl. It was winter and already dark. Her grandfather had been trapped under a fallen wardrobe and couldn't move. When I met her, she was walking along the road and clutching 2 bottles of water. It was all she had. She then tried to give them to me as I'd been delivering food. There were so many people in terrible situations, but they were being so kind. I was very moved by that.
The sight of all of these tattooed bikers and even some ex-convicts helping out caught the attention of some journalists. It's when Narita shows me some of the news articles written, I realise how harrowing some of the work they were doing was.
We were digging in the rubble to look for bodies, even just a leg, because so many still hasn't been recovered. And when we'd find it, we'd try to get the remains back to the people's families.
And so when you saw all of these horrific sights, did it make you think that you wanted to do more?
When I got back to Tokyo, I found that lots of people had brought donations to my motorbike shop. My friends, other people in the motorbike world, and tattoo artists had been collecting resources, and they had started to call the effort Support the Underground, because we were all considered kind of subculture in Japan. And then it just got bigger and bigger. I didn't plan it in the beginning. It just happened. So I just kept going back up with supplies.
And people didn't just come from Tokyo. Friends from all over the country gathered supplies and offered their help. I travelled to the city of Kobe, 320 miles west of the capital, to meet Kimitoshi Tokiyama. He's known Narita for over two decades and also owns a custom bike shop. He went up north with Support the Underground multiple times.
I decided to help out because there was an earthquake in my home city of Kobe 20 years ago. My relatives' houses were totally destroyed, and at the time, so many people came to help us. So, when I heard about the earthquake in the north, it didn't feel like someone else's business. It felt like the same had happened to me.
Back in Tokyo with Narita, and the effort hasn't stopped. So that was the 2011 earthquake and tsunami, but since then, can you tell me about what work you're doing now?
When the first disaster happened, I told everyone I would continue to do this. And so I will continue until they tell me they don't need help anymore.
Tomohiro Narita there. He told his story to Emily Webb from the BBC's Outlook program. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Indian state of Kerala is doubling down on fabrication labs, spaces where you can use the latest technology to get your hands dirty.
Engineers in particular need to have hands-on experience. They can sort of turbocharge their imaginations in terms of what's possible.
Fab Labs in India, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. If I told you that Pakistan's biggest city, Karachi, has a new mayor, that'd be a shrug, probably. He was sworn in today, in fact. And after the swearing-in, he went back to jail. Yeah, now you're not shrugging. I've got Bina Sarwar here to explain. She's a journalist and documentary filmmaker from Karachi. Bina, tell us who this new mayor is and why is he in jail?
Waseem Akhtar is a old-time worker with the Mutahida Qaumi Movement, the MQM, which is probably Karachi's strongest party still, even though it's had a lot of knocks in the recent years. And he is in jail because he is being accused under the terrorism court, by an anti-terrorism court, of aiding and abetting another party worker or former federal minister called Dr. Asim Hussain, who runs a hospital, at which he's been accused of sheltering or helping criminals and terrorists. And Waseem Akhtar has been in and out of jail for some months. He's gotten pre-arrest bail before, and his bail was rejected recently, and he was produced handcuffed at an anti-terrorist court before being put in jail in July last month.
Right. He was elected mayor last month, Waseem Akhtar was. And
he
was just
elected mayor.
Yeah.
Now.
And he was, at the time of the vote, he was already in jail, right?
At the time of the vote, he was in jail. And he was brought in for the swearing in under police escort, not handcuffed this time.
Yeah. So explain how this works. You can run for office in Pakistan if you're in jail?
So he's been accused. He's facing charges. He has not been convicted. No charges against him have been proved so far. Much earlier this year, I think in January it was, he was being arrested for violating Section 144, which is a British era law according to which groups of more than four people cannot be together in public. It is a crowd control measure. And for loudspeaker misuse. I mean, those are kind of ridiculous charges in a way. Mm. But he was given pre-arrest bail for those charges. But these charges, again, like I said, he's been accused and the bail was rejected. But lawyers in Karachi. I was just speaking to a friend there, and they say that the court is going to have to give him bail, have to grant him bail. He cannot be running the affairs of the city, obviously, from behind the bars, as you pointed out. They have no reason to not grant him bail. And if they do not grant him bail, then it was going to be pretty bad for Karachi, because MQM still enjoys very wide support.
Is there a mayor if he's not granted bail?
Apparently, he's asked for an office to be set up in prison so he can run the affairs of the city from that position.
Wow.
But I don't think that's a likely scenario. And this whole thing can become really ugly and very messy if he doesn't get the bail that he is entitled to, which is his right as somebody who has not been convicted.
So today at his swearing in, what did Wasim Akhtar have to say about his mayorship? Do we know?
He made conciliatory noises. He said that he was going to work together with everybody. He said that he would work together with their main rivals. Their main political rivals in Karachi are former cricket captain, cricket hero, if you will, Imran Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, the PTI. And that has not been the MQM's earlier modus operandi. They've been pretty much a law unto themselves.
Bina, this whole story and everything I've ever read about Karachi, I mean, it sounds like it's different from other cities in Pakistan. I know there's a lot of corruption there, but it's also outsized. Things seem to run just differently. I mean, you're from Karachi. What is it about this city that seems to distort it, where you end up with a mayor who's in jail?
What makes Karachi different is that it's a microcosm of the country. You have representations of all ethnicities, religions, races, politics in Pakistan, in Karachi, which is the country's largest city of about 20 million, which is huge. Mm. It's a sprawling city. And because it's a melting pot, and that's something that I guess, it's like America in that way, or like New York, or it's the place where everybody comes for jobs, for opportunity. I guess that's what makes it different from the other cities, where you are identified by your caste or who your family is or where you were educated. In Karachi, you can be self-made, and MQM is a self-made party. It's a party where you don't have to be rich or own land or have connections to powerful families to be in politics. And that's what makes the politics of Karachi different.
Journalist and documentary filmmaker Bina Sarwar, thanks very much for helping us out here.
Thank you, Marco.
This next story is about fab labs, fab as in fabrication. It's a whole new way of thinking about making stuff and spurring technological innovation. Mary Kay Magsad recently visited a fab lab in Kochi in India. Mary Kay is the host of our podcast, Whose Century Is It?, which explores the ideas and trends shaping the future. I asked her what it was like to see India running with the fab lab concept.
They're running pretty fast with it. So it's they actually have two fab labs now, one in Kochi and one in the capital of Kerala, Trivandrum. They're planning to open 20 more mini fab labs in engineering colleges. And the idea is that engineers in particular need to have hands-on experience. They can't just know theory and not know the practice. And that by making themselves with high-tech tools, it can sort of turbocharge their imaginations in terms of what's possible. Kerala has a long-term goal of becoming a hub for, Internet of Things type innovations. And with fab labs, you can make things that are at that sort of high-tech level, where you have smart objects that can go in the home and, that increasingly people are expected to integrate into their lives.
Yeah, so when you went to this fab lab in Kochi, what did it look like and what kind of activity was going on there? Kind of like a techie sandbox that it's supposed to be?
Right. So the fab labs, which started at MIT in the Center for Bits and Atoms, all look quite similar. Laser cutters and 3D printers and a CNC router. And, basically there are infinite possibilities for people to take these and put them together. And what has happened so far in the year or so that the fab labs have been opened in Kerala is that you've had startup entrepreneurs coming in and making their prototypes there. There have also been students who have come in and who have actually taken a class at MIT, and they're connected in real time, but also with other fab labs around the world where students are taking the class. And they really like this idea that other fab labs are connected with each other through cameras that are on pretty much all the time. So if someone's sitting in the fab lab and sort of hits a snag and isn't quite sure how to proceed, he can say, hey, anyone, can you help me with this? Quite often someone will show up and will say, oh, okay, well, we've tried this. How about if you do that?
It's the kind of problems I gather these fab labs are intending to solve. That's intriguing. I want us to hear what the technical officer for the program in Kochi told you about that.
Fab Labs' concept is to solve problems which are identified locally. There is no point in doing a research where normal people's problems are not solved.
So, Mary Kay, is that what you found, that this movement is trying to solve the problems of normal people?
Well, I think that's certainly one of the goals. But one of the problems of ordinary people is to just, at least in Kerala, which is already, you know, India's most literate state, the vast majority know how to use smartphones and computers and so forth. And now they're trying to promote F literacy, which is fabrication literacy. So one of the steps they're taking is to just try to pull everyone up in terms of knowledge of how to make what they use and use what they make. So they've been getting something called Raspberry Pis out to middle school students and high school students.
Now,
this is not dessert.
Okay, I figured it wasn't.
This is a very small computer. It's basically a circuit board. Students can take those and embed them into objects. They can make computers themselves. There was one student who came up with the idea of how he could monitor which government employees were showing up for work by putting together this little gadget where, you know, it would keep track of who was going into what room and when they were leaving. So there's a lot of interesting ways in which students are finding ways to solve local problems. I think, you know, they feel very confident that they're moving in the right direction. You know, they love the fact that they can interact with fab labs around the world and benefit from the expertise at MIT.
One of the Indian proponents of this whole idea, whom you interviewed, says it's a very ambitious dream. Is that suggesting that it will be challenging to get to the point where Indian engineers will stay in India and help foster innovation there as opposed to leaving and contributing to the brain drain?
Right. There have been a lot of really gifted engineers and entrepreneurs who have gone off to Silicon Valley and elsewhere, and they don't often come back. And so the government of Kerala is saying, we want them to come back. We want them to take, you know, what they're able to do and do it for us here and help India become more of a leading player in the world in technology, but also specifically in fab labs and in the Internet of Things. So, you know, we want to bring up the level of our engineers in Kerala, but we'd also like to incentivize more of them to stay in Kerala and do their best work here.
Mary Kay Magstad, the host of the World's podcast, Whose Century Is It?, telling us about Fab Labs. Thanks a lot, Mary Kay.
Thanks, Marco.
And while we're thinking about the future, remember the Concorde, the sleek jet with a pointy nose that broke the sound barrier every time it flew from New York to London or Paris? Well, it's been more than a decade since the Concorde stopped flying its high-speed shuttle routes. But the days of supersonic flight may not be over. A handful of companies are designing jets that could transport people faster than the speed of sound. The World's Jason Margolis profiles one such company based right here in Boston.
A few years ago, entrepreneur Vic Kachoria was spending a lot of time up in the clouds, flying from Boston to Europe to Asia. He had plenty of time to ponder this question.
Like, why aren't we flying any faster?
Computers have gotten faster, trains are faster, everything is faster.
In every industry we look at, except for aviation.
In fact, you could argue aviation technology has gone backwards. We used to be able to fly twice as fast on the Concorde not long ago. That plane was designed in the 1960s. The Concorde went belly up in 2003, largely for lack of customers. Kachoria, who began his career with NASA, figured it shouldn't be that hard to create a new and improved supersonic jet, and one at a fraction of the cost.
The software has gotten to the level where we can do things in hours for a few $100,000. Just 10 years ago, it would have cost hundreds of millions of dollars because you'd have to fabricate test aircraft. Now we can do it in computer simulation.
Kachoria has a team of engineers in Boston working on a new 18-passenger plane geared at business travelers. The startup is called Spike Aerospace. A handful of other companies are also working on supersonic models. They're all promising big things. The return to the days of sipping champagne at more than 1,000 miles per hour, it's a romantic image. But John Hansman at MIT says there's a reason it hasn't happened again.
The problem is the physics are hard to beat because it's just fundamentally difficult to go faster than the speed of sound.
Hansman teaches aeronautics and astronautics to some of the smartest university students on the planet. but I asked him to explain flight and the sound barrier as if he was talking to a ninth grade science class.
So when something goes faster than the speed of sound, be it a bullet, an airplane, or anything, it creates basically a pressure wave. So the speed of sound is the fastest something can propagate through the atmosphere. Well, no, it's too complicated. Okay.
It is complicated. To oversimplify matters, the faster a plane goes, the more drag it creates. This means specially built engines need to work harder to punch through the sound barrier. It's achievable, but only at a very high cost.
You have to burn a lot more fuel than you would burn in a conventional airplane.
That's partly why, back in the day, round-trip tickets on the Concorde, New York to London, cost about $12,000. Even with all the odds stacked against supersonic travel, Vic Kachoria claims that a seat on one of his planes will cost the same as a business ticket today. He also wants to transform the flying experience, make the seats comfier, reduce outside noise, and get rid of windows to actually give you a better view of the outside.
And inside you put a very flat screen, digital screen, that we all have in our homes. You make it the entire length of the fuselage. And you put cameras all around the aircraft, so you can look left or right or up or down. At night, you can look at the stars. You get the best view of the starry night inside this cabin.
Who wouldn't want a seat on that plane? Speedy jets could also transform the very nature of business travel, says Amy Cohn. She focuses on aviation scheduling and logistics at the University of Michigan.
It's appealing to me to think that I could fly over to Europe, have a meeting, and fly back. And I have actually, you know, occasionally done these, spend 12 hours flying to spend 6 hours there to get on a plane and come home, and that's not fun.
Still, she questions the demand for this, especially in this day and age.
Today versus the time of the Concorde, the technology to be doing remote business meetings is a whole lot more sophisticated.
But if people like the idea of face-to-face meetings using supersonic travel, there will also be a much bigger environmental cost, burning huge amounts of fuel, creating more greenhouse gases. And then there's that tricky sonic boom thing. The Concorde couldn't fly over land because of the noise disruption it would have created below. Even if a new jet could cut the LA to New York flight time to 3 hours, John Hansman at MIT says it would get busted for speeding.
So we literally have a speed limit in the U.S., and unless you're a military airplane, you will get violated if you fly faster than the speed of sound.
It's not that Vic Kachoria with Spike Aerospace doesn't see these challenges, but he also sees something else.
2 years ago, 3 billion people took a flight somewhere. 3 billion people. Right now, there's 100,000 aircraft up in the air at any one time.
That's a lot of potential customers. Kachoria hopes to be serving some in about 7 years. For The World, Jason Margolis, Boston.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Paris to Washington, it's time to call it quits. Or in the words of French President François Hollande, negotiations are bogged down, positions have not been respected. We're not talking about a formal divorce or anything. It's TTIP that's in danger of falling apart. That'd be the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, a massive trade deal the U.S. and Europe have been negotiating for 3 years. Not to be confused with TPP, the Trans-Pacific Trade Deal. To get a handle on what's at stake here, we've got Edward Alden on the line from the Council on Foreign Relations. First of all, Edward, for the unenlightened on global trade issues, and that would include myself, what is TTIP?
TTIP is a trade negotiation between the United States and the European Union that has been going on now for more than 3 years. And the goal is to get rid of the remaining mostly small tariffs in place between the U.S. and Europe on the trade front, but really more significantly to try to align regulations, consumer safety provisions, other aspects of economic management in the United States and Europe in ways that will encourage U.S. companies to invest in Europe, encourage European companies to invest in the United States, boost trade and investment for both, and hopefully accelerate economic growth. So it's a deeper trade agreement than most that have been negotiated previously, and thus harder to pull off.
Why does that agreement need to be deeper? Because Europe is already America's biggest trading partner, and, you know, U.S. and Europe are pretty friendly.
Well, I think there were a number of motivations here. I think one was just to try to boost economic growth in Europe, which has been pretty sluggish coming out of the Great Recession. I also think there were real geostrategic goals here, desire to push back against Russian influence in Europe, the desire to show that both the U.S. and Europe could continue to play a leading role in global trade. There were multiple motivations here, which I think went beyond just trade growth.
So why are these negotiations around TTIP running into such trouble now?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One, I think they are hard. Tariff negotiations tend to be relatively easy. You know, you cut from 10 to 5 and we'll cut from 7 to 4 and we'll saw it off there. These negotiations get into much tougher issues having to do with how do you regulate products? You know, take auto safety, for example. You know, what are the standards for airbags in cars? They're different in Europe than they are in the United States, even though people are more or less the same in both places. Agriculture is really hard. In the United States, processors are allowed to bathe our chickens in a sort of light chlorine bath to disinfect them. The Europeans think that's an abominable idea. Mm-hmm. Genetically modified products, another big issue. So there are a lot of points of real contention when you get into these regulatory questions. And they're a lot harder to deal with than the old tariff issue. So I'm not surprised the talks have run into difficulty.
A lot of Americans have become jaded, as you probably know, about these big international trade deals. What would be the effect on Americans if TTIP fails?
Well, I think the economic effects will probably be fairly small because, as you mentioned at the outset, trade is already pretty robust between the United States and the European Union. I think the bigger damage will be to the U.S. global position. I mean, if you look at both these trade deals, they're about the United States playing a leading role in establishing global trade rules vis-a-vis China in Asia with the TPP and vis-a-vis Russia in Europe with the TTIP. I think if both these deals go down in flames, which is quite possible, the U.S. position in the world is going to be much weaker. And I think that's a longer-term concern for the United States and for ordinary Americans as well.
Do you think TTIP's going to fail?
I think the odds are really against it at this point. It's looking like a long, drawn-out, perhaps two-year process in Europe for ratification. There's strong public opposition to the TTIP in Germany and France. The UK is now out, and so the United States' closest ally on trade talks in Europe is out of the picture. So I think clearly the TTIP is in big trouble.
Edward Alden is with the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. Thanks for explaining this to us.
Yeah, great to be with you, Marco.
I began today talking about the decision of 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick to not stand for the national anthem at football games. It's caused a lot of debate, to say the least. One part of the argument, something even Kaepernick may not have known about, is a debate over the anthem's little-known third stanza and whether it's actually racist. Take a listen to it.
No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight, nor the gloom of the grave.
No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. The meaning of that verse might be a little confusing, but writer and academic Jason Johnson knows the story. Johnson teaches at Morgan State University in Baltimore. And Jason, you're in Baltimore, ground zero for Francis Scott Key, who wrote his famous poem after witnessing the failed British assault on Fort McHenry. That was 1814. What is this third verse about?
Essentially, Francis Scott Key was happy to see former slaves who had joined the British as part of the Colonial Marines getting slaughtered and killed as they attempted to take Baltimore. And the entire song sort of leads up to this point where he's essentially saying, these terrible, ungrateful black people, this is the consequence of standing up against the United States of America. So it's clearly racist, it's clearly pro-slavery, but it's pretty much in line with the kind of man that Francis Scott Key was.
So I gather Francis Scott Key never really told anybody what he meant, and some historians interpret his mention of hirelings and slaves to reference all of the invading British forces. Similar rhetoric had been used. Are we sure this historical analysis isn't some kind of projection on a past that we know a lot better about now?
Well, that's the best thing about history, which is usually, if you can find enough evidence and documentation, it doesn't change that much. What we know about Francis Scott Key is, while, yes, he occasionally protected freedmen as a lawyer, he was also known to have helped incite a race riot. He was strongly in favor of slavery. He was in favor of freedmen being sent back to Africa because he feared what they might do if they were allowed to stay in the United States and become rabble-rousers. And also, historians believe, certainly around the Baltimore area, that when Francis Scott Key was a lieutenant, he battled a group of black colonial marines in the Battle of Bladensburg, and he was beaten badly.
Wow.
In fact, his troops were slaughtered so aggressively that he had to run home and hide in Washington, D.C. So this was personal for him in addition to racial.
So I don't really know much about the colonial marines. These were black troops in British pay. Tell us more about them.
Well, basically what happened is that the British said, look, to former slaves, to freedmen, and to current slaves, if you escape and you take up arms against the nation that enslaved you, we will give you your freedom. So it was an amazing opportunity for a lot of African Americans to fight for their freedom.
So another thing I did not know, that the national anthem became official law, the official national anthem, only in 1931. And the law states, I looked this up, all other persons present should face the flag and stand at attention with their right hand over the heart. So Colin Kaepernick, could he get arrested for this?
You know, to get into the technicalities as to whether or not Colin Kaepernick broke the law, maybe he did. It's not a law that's going to be enforced. And more importantly, his constitutional right to freedom of expression would trump any potential violation of how he deals with the flag. So he's on solid ground legally, at least under most administrations we've known in the United States.
Jason Johnson, associate professor at Morgan State in Baltimore. He's got a great article on this whole issue on The Root. Jason, thanks for your time.
Thanks. Anytime.
And here in Boston at the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.